welcome to the Sportsman Drag Racing Legends podcast, brought to you by the Class Racing Podcast with Aaron and Chuck. I'm your host, Mike Delahanty, and I'll bring you stories and conversations with some of the true legends of stock, super stock, and modified sportsman drag racing. This podcast is sponsored by Race Tools Direct. Race Tools Direct was founded to be your choice for quality tools and products that have been carefully selected and thoroughly tested both at the track and the shop by racers for racers. To place an order, go to racetoolsdirect.com or call 440-941-8533. This is Season 1, Episode 7. In this episode, I talk with Al Korda. With a racing career spanning 52 years and 20 cars, Al Korda remains as one of the toughest competitors that any racer could find in the other lane. Al's stock eliminator win at the NHRA 1971 Indianapolis Nationals put him on a path that would deliver consistent winning performance for half of a century. Al is not your stereotypical drag racer. He's a mechanical engineer with a graduate business degree that decided early in life that to make it big, he needed to control his own destiny. That plan led him to buy his own drag strip in Wisconsin in the mid-1970s. Al started his racing career with a succession of Max Wedge Mopars and used a Hemi Power Challenger to win his first world championship in 1986. Always one to have an eye for the most competitive combination, Al made the leap to modern fuel-injected Pontiac Firebirds in 2000 and continues to race an LS-powered Copo today. Al has recorded a long list of wins and achievements in his 52 years of racing. Here are just a few of the highlights. Two-time NHRA Stock Eliminator World Champion. 24 NHRA National Event Final Rounds, where Al won 14. 1986 Quaker Cup Champion, which was awarded to the NHRA Sportsman Racer who scored the most points nationally. A two-time member of the CarCraft Magazine All-Star Drag Team. Winner of the first ever IHRA Top Stock Race. The first NHRA Small Block Stocker in the nines. And Al was inducted into the NHRA Division 5 Hall of Fame. I had a chance to speak with Al in early April. And listeners, please stay tuned at the end of the episode for some special bonus audio from Al. I think you'll find it entertaining.
With us for this episode is Al Korda. So Al, I'd like to welcome you to the Legends of Sportsman Drag Racing and certainly appreciate you taking the time to share some of your career stories.
Thanks, Mike. It's always fun to talk to you.
So Al and I will share that Al and I did spend some time talking last night. And actually, Al and I talk whenever we see each other at the track. I want to point out something, and I made this observation to Al, I think it was last year, but for those that know Al, I want you to think about this, and those that maybe haven't met Al, but you'll notice whenever you see Al at the track, he's always very nicely dressed in what I call drag strip casual with a collared, button-down collar shirt. Right, Al?
Maybe not always, but most of the time that happens to be true.
Right. Al, I don't think I've ever seen you in a t-shirt at the drag strip.
You know, I'd have to be underneath the car. And, of course, anybody who knows me realizes that I don't crawl underneath the car very often.
At least in public.
That's true.
Okay. I usually start things off, I guess the first question is, how did you get started? What was it that got you hooked and progression of cars in the early days?
Mike, got started when I was 16 years old or so. Ended up going to the Minneapolis Dragways, or Minnesota Dragways as it was called, and seeing some of the neat Max Wedge Plymouths and Dodges back in the day. Always kind of liked them a little bit. That one might have been in 63 or 64. A couple of years later, I'd saved up enough money to buy a 1966 Dodge. It was a street strip 383 66 Dodge Coronet 500.
That was basically a new car that you bought?
Yeah, it was a one-year-old car. And like I said, okay. I'd been working at the drive-in theater and the Coca-Cola bottling factory and saved up a few shekels and bought that 1966 Dodge and kind of turned it into a street strip deal, like, you know, the standard deal, added some gears, added a camshaft and a headers and raced it a little bit and got a little bit more serious about it the next year. Ended up went down to outside of Chicago and I remember buying a 1963 red and white Max Wedge Dodge for $800 or $900. I remember laying the money on the guy's fender and tow bar and the thing home or something to that effect. And that's how I got my start in the Max Wedges. And as Mike, you know, you're an old Max Wedge guy from way back.
So, I mean, for your first race car, that's, you know, I saw the picture of your first race car is an A-stock automatic car. You're jumping in deep water there, aren't you?
You know, at the time, it didn't seem like it. Just to put things in reference, you know, the famed Ford driver, Richard Charbonneau, actually drove a Max Wedge Plymouth back in the Minnesota Dragway days of the 1963-1964 before he got onto the Ford bandwagon. But, yeah, I ran into another friend of mine by the name of Mike Polk, who had some Max Wedges, and the Max Wedges were just popular back in the mid-60s time. Right. And this one came up for grabs, and I ended up buying it. Unfortunately, I didn't keep it forever. The rules changed and whatnot. And I first started racing, raced near Green Bay, Wisconsin, at a little track called Kaukauna, Wisconsin. And in those days, I think the sanctioning body that they used was NADS or something like that, where they were running formula stockers. Formula stockers just simply means it was based on cubic inches, weight, and number of carburetors, if I recall. I guess they were called formula stockers or something like that, but a funny story or a funny part of that, I was involved with one of the best engine builders in Minneapolis and still at the time, in those days and still today, it was a place called Wheeler Racing Engines, put together an engine. He never did any assembly, but he would do the machine work on it. And I can actually remember assembling the motor and trying to make a clean room out of old white sheets in a garage. hanging up about, let's say a half a dozen white sheets so that I could assemble this motor in a so-called clean room. It's kind of fun.
Your little operating room.
That's exactly what it was. It was my version of an operating room.
That's great.
We got, that car was fairly competitive on the formula stock deal. Of course, at that time, didn't do any NHRA racing at all. But I had some influence from the guys at Minnesota Dragways. And
you were still pretty young at that point, right?
Oh, gosh, what would that be? 20 years old or something like that, 21?
So, pretty young to be running a car like that.
Well, I don't think it seemed like that big of a deal at the time. But it was a pretty decent car, and I can remember, it must have been halfway decent because I can remember getting the P&G test on it a couple of times at the little track south of Green Bay. It's always turned up. But the guys at Wheeler Engines, Gary Schmidt and originally Jack Wheeler and Jeff Fiala, they helped me a lot in that. But it turned out after just 1 year with it, I recognized that it just had traction problems in those days. The tires weren't as good as they are today.
Right.
And ended up switching it over to a black 63 Plymouth wagon.
Okay.
Just for the weight transfer issue. And ran that for a little bit and actually probably only ran it 1 year. And then decided that the 64 Plymouth, don't remember all the details on it, but the 64 Plymouth was a better deal and had a local Chrysler Plymouth dealership by the name of Brickner get on the bandwagon, and they painted the car bright yellow for me, ran that car. It was a car that subsequently, the next year later, got painted red, white, and blue under the guise of a Road America ignition sponsorship.
Yeah, I remember those. Yep.
And they had a little logo that said, a little heart that said, "Love is a high performance thing." My friend Jim Wick, who passed away, but had a '68 Hemi Cuda real car.
Right. He was always featured in their advertisements.
Absolutely. And he was located in the same town as Road America Ignition, or better known as Wells, or officially known as Wells Manufacturing. And he ended up helping me get a deal, or put me on the, quote, the Road America team, and repainted the car red, white, and blue. It's kind of a unique car in that it was a wagon, and it had the capability of running both a six-passenger and a nine-passenger option on it, either way. And in those days, I know that you remember this, but some of the sport fans maybe don't, but you couldn't change three classes like you can in Stock Eliminator today.
Right.
You could only run the class that it was at, that it was rated at. And, oh, by the way, you had to, if the factor was 9 1/4, you had to run it 9 1/4 pounds, not bring it all the way down to 9 pounds or anything like that. So back in the day, the rules were such that I thought that the 64 car was a better, the 64 Max, which was a little better car than the 63.
All your cars from day one, every picture I've ever seen, has the real big Al Korda on the side. What inspired that? I mean, that's your trademark.
Well, that's kind of a deal. I used to say, when anybody would ask me about it, of course, everybody recognizes that race car guys generally have a fairly big ego, and I'm sure at the time mine was even larger than most. The real reason was that I always used is that when you'd be trying to get some help from the oil companies or the tire companies or whoever you were trying to get a little help from, I always thought it was counterproductive to say, "Hi, this is Al from the big tank Plymouth wagon."
Yeah, okay.
Calling, and I need some free part.
Right.
So instead of that, I decided, no, I'll start with the big name on the door and say, "Hey, my name is Al Korda, and I need some help." But or as we used to say in the business, "Hi, my name is Al Korda. I'm fun to be with. send me some help."
That's okay.
And that's certainly I jest in that, and that's an oversimplification of it, but. I remember that they used to laugh at first car, the red and white car, because
yeah.
They called it circus lettering on the side of it. And I remember you had said that at one point in time you had never seen a picture of that car. It was kind of a local car. It wasn't. We didn't run that at any of the NHRA stuff, and it
right.
only lasted for a year. But
yeah.
It definitely had the curly Q in the center, circus letters on it, and that was the days before vinyl lettering. And some of the sport fans out there don't know this, but Mike started out, I remember, having a little side business of vinyl lettering way back in the day when he had before he had his Max Wedge, and I think he had a black Oldsmobile, if I remember correctly.
Right. That's correct. How I paid for all the racing, and it worked. There's some of my vinyl that ended up on a couple of your cars.
Of course. I definitely I remember doing business with you way back when. And,
yep.
I'll go back to 1971.
All right.
Because I went to the U.S. Nationals in 1971,
yeah.
And it was a rain-delayed deal to Monday. I remember having to call into my employer and say, "Hey, I'm not going to be there." And it's Labor Day, got rained out. They were going to race it on Tuesday. And say, "Hey, I'm not going to be at work on Tuesday." "Okay, come on in on Wednesday." "All right." Well, anyway, I lucked out and won the whole Stock Eliminator at the 71 Nationals. And it was interesting because I was listening to DeVortman talk about losing, and at the time I didn't realize that he had won that many races.
Yeah.
And that I lucked out and beat him in the semifinals when the breakout was in effect. And, of course, in the final, there was no breakout. And as strange as it may be, in 1971, ended up racing another Max Wedge of a Chrysler dynamometer operator. I think you probably know him, Ted Flack.
Yeah, no, Ted Flack, well.
And raced him and was lucky enough to get the edge and get the nod on that race.
For that big win at Indy, and we'll talk a little more about that, but for the big win at Indy, what kind of NHRA racing were you doing that, you know, divisional stuff, or had you run any national events prior to the 71 Indy race?
You know, I think I might have gone down to Indy the year before.
Okay.
And but, you know, back in those days, they didn't have as many national events as they did. And
right.
I know I would have gone to the Brainerd, Minnesota points meet and all that, but pretty much fledgling on that. So you can imagine, well, in my mind, the hook was set, and maybe I didn't realize that the hook was set for life in my cheek, but it certainly turned out that way, where I made race, not necessarily racing, but race-oriented in the track ownership, that type of thing.
Right.
And into a lifelong dream, if you would.
But, you shared with me, you know, earlier, your win was $10,000. So I did that. I Googled and did some math work. That $10,000 purse in 71, if that were today, that'd be $64,566.
It sure seemed like a lot of money then. And,
wow.
we don't do this for money. That's for sure. It was more lucrative. And as you might imagine, I would say that race cars probably cost $3,000 back in the day.
Yeah.
You probably, maybe a little bit more, but someplace in that vicinity. I remember, well, that particular wagon came out of a, it was a six-cylinder car, came out of a junkyard. The dealer repainted it. It got repainted twice, I guess.
Yeah, right.
It changed colors to red, white, and blue. But I remember, I guess that we went to a few point meets in that year because I actually did qualify to go down to Amarillo, Texas for the World Finals.
Okay, yeah.
Again, the Dave Bortman name shows up in 1971 at Amarillo. They were just finishing up some of the track. I can remember finishing up paving. They were doing asphalt paving, not on the track, but on some of the side roads and whatnot as we were coming in the gate. But in those days, only the 5 point leaders from each of the divisions were invited down there, and then it was a 16-car field, fastest qualifier. Well, I'm sorry, it was a 16-car field, but actually 7 division point leaders were automatically seated in the
mm-hmm.
race,
right.
And that left 9 spots open to qualify. And it, let's just say there'd be 35 cars there and vying for 9 spots. And the wagon was fairly fast and got all the way down to the final and didn't have enough beans to keep up with that Bortman car. And so it was kind of payback. I remember at the time having to couldn't catch him and
yep.
Slid on the, you know, tapped the brakes and still went 10 numbers under or something, still went under and end up having to tear the cars down in windy Amarillo, Texas. But there's a interesting side note on there that that'll be that I don't even think I've shared with you, and that is they decide they're going to tear us down because we set records. But it was late in the day, the wind was blowing, and the so-called technical inspection toolbox had already left the track with one of the tech guys. And you know, it's maybe 4 or 5 o'clock, and
yeah.
And the tech box had left at 2 or 3 o'clock in the afternoon.
Okay.
So they're trying to check these cars without any. At first, I thought, well, they don't have any tools. They're not even going to check it. So I'm lollygagging around.
Right.
And finally, I recognize that they're really going to tear the cylinder heads off. So we get after it and take the cylinder head off. But and this is the God's honest truth. They're instead of having a Rimac tester, valve spring tester, and in those days you had spring specs on it.
Yep. Right.
But they. I swear to God, they checked the valve springs by measuring the height with a wooden ruler. and saying, well, it's close to the installed height, so it must be correct. Not even imagining that you could have a different coil spring rate on the spring. But again, why do I remember some of those stories? I don't have the faintest idea, but they're pretty. So again, the car was certified correct, and we walk away with the record. And in those days, you had to race off of the record, so that was kind of a blessing in disguise. You're the national record holder, but oh, now you got to race off of it. So.
Right.
So, kind of so the
Indy win, that had to not only, nice, significant payday, but it had to open up doors and get your connections, that paid off going forward.
Well, certainly it was helpful, but, I wasn't very well connected with all the ins and outs of NHRA at the time. And in 1971, all of a sudden, at the end of the year, they said, well, we're going to switch all these stockers into, we're going to move you up to super stock, and we're going to create a brand new class called pure stock, or change stock into pure stock. And as you might imagine, the class would, well, it was a lot different rules.
Right.
Everything stock, and even to the point where you had to drive the cars to the track, or supposedly drive the cars to the track.
Yep.
Well, 71 was kind of a funny year for me. I graduated from the University of Wisconsin with a mechanical engineering degree, so here I am as a fledgling engineer, but I was a January graduate.
Okay.
And lucky for me, one of the things that happens in engineering school is you always try to get a summer job, what was known as an intern job, a summer job that was in a meaningful, something to do with your engineering degree,
right?
In a meaningful part of industry. Well, I was lucky enough to work for an electric motor and generator company in my hometown of Wausau, Wisconsin, in central Wisconsin, and worked there the summer before, and then had a chance to work for them the next year. And they had kind of a one-year training program, and I was kind of a weird duck in that I got into technical sales, or sales engineering, as they called it at the time. So that ended up going on a one-year training program in the various departments of this electric motor company.
Right.
In preparation for going out to the field. And so that leads me to the next step. At the end of 1 year, I got transferred out to Pennsylvania in a town called Allentown, Pennsylvania, kind
right.
of near the border of New Jersey.
Yeah.
North of Philadelphia.
Yeah, I had an aunt that lived there.
Well, there you go. It,
okay.
Small world.
Yeah.
The wagon didn't seem like the best idea in switching to Superstock. And I found a Shell 64 Fury convertible, or some kind of 64 Plymouth B-body convertible. Put the motor and trans in there and bumped it up with switched the camshaft a little bit, but that was all it did. And turned out to be a decent car. Matter of fact, so decent, it was maybe a year later or something like that, it actually set the Superstock F-Automatic mile-an-hour record, and I never, was very good at mile-an-hour record, or very good at national records, but set it and ended up racing that car almost every Saturday night at Maple Grove Dragway. There was more fun at that track than you can shake a stick at. It was just a lot of fun.
And yeah, great racing. Great racing at Maple Grove.
Superstock racing and of course, it was at that time, 72, 3, 4, you were racing off records, and it was a money class, and the car, like I said, the car was fairly competitive, the convertible. But one of the neat things that Maple Grove had, they were way ahead of their time, they had a points fund, a year-long points fund, that, if you can imagine this, paid $5,000 to win the annual points chase.
Right, and I did my math on that too, Al. In today's money,
you're a big math guy.
$27,811. That is great money for a weekly track points program.
And they had, they worked the advertisers to fund the program, and they called it the money trail. And
the money trail.
I I think I came in seventh race the first year and missed the thing in the second year that I was there, whatever that would be, 1973. Came in second and finally won the thing in 1975. Fun time.
Yeah, it was great. I raced there. In fact, I tied for ninth in 1977, if that means anything.
So there you go. Absolutely. You know, you can see how you get hooked on it.
Right.
In my mind, it was a big feather in the cap because it was, first of all, it was just a lot of fun. Mostly Saturday night racing.
Yeah.
And Allentown wasn't too far from Reading. I think it was an hour plus, only 50, 60 miles away, and just a lot of fun racing in there.
Okay. So, I mean, the next big milestone I'm looking at here in your career is the track purchase. And so I want to understand this transition from, so you're a sales engineer for an electric motor company, a mechanical engineer. I think you all, somewhere along the line, you also went and got your graduate degree in MBA, right?
Well, it goes back a little bit. I all of a sudden got transferred again and ended up in Hartford, Connecticut, or a little bit north of Hartford, Connecticut.
Okay.
And there really wasn't much racing going on there.
Right.
I actually sold the race car and started doing a street strip max wedge deal, or a collector car max wedge.
Mm-hmm.
But I was in Connecticut, and all of a sudden, my dream job in marketing opened up back in Wisconsin at the factory location, a marketing manager's job.
Right.
And in generators as opposed to electric motors. And it was a fun, I always loved the generators because the crowd was the diesel engine customers and whatnot that were putting generator sets together, et cetera. So ended up moving back to Wisconsin at that time. It just caught up with you, I guess, filling in the blanks or connecting the dots. At the time, MBAs or Masters of Business Administration were, it was a big deal to tie in with a technical background. So I started going to night school at various places in the University of Wisconsin network.
Mm-hmm.
It was a slow but sure deal, needed a lot of prereqs and all that kind of stuff. But as I got on a little bit further, I came to the conclusion that I wanted to be in business for myself, and that in order to make it big, I needed to be in business for myself. And sure enough, ended up seeing this drag strip 100 miles away come up for sale.
Okay.
And it was an independent drag strip. It was called Ambergreen at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And a doctor, a radiologist, had owned the place, and he had basically built the track. To give him credit, he had built the track to keep his sons on a straight and narrow, keep them occupied and whatnot, and he had built it 10 years earlier. And he was getting, and of course the sons moved on and he was getting tired of it. And I remember, and this dates it, but I remember going over to put a presentation on him with a flip chart. No computers back in at that time frame or anything to speak of. Went there with another racer who happens to be my CPA, and you may recognize the name Tom Rota.
Oh, yeah.
So he and I went over there and pitched this deal, got the nod to buy the thing on the long-arm mortgage deal and whatnot, got into the drag strip business. And it was, as any small business starts out, you have big dreams and you can draw all the curves and the business plans you want, and then all of a sudden you get slapped in the face with the real world of saying, maybe this isn't going to be quite as easy as it looked from the outside.
I mean, how many times did you question, like, oh, Al, why did you do this? Or was it like, this is great, I love it, and I've found my dream vocation?
No, it's the tough thing. I know that I went into it making the projections, of course, just playing on your mathematical projections that you already mentioned. I just had to laugh because this track was open maybe 8 times a year in the summer. And I said, oh, I know how to fix this. We'll open it up and we'll run every weekend. We'll run every weekend. And, oh, by the way, in June, July, and August, we'll run on Saturday and Sunday. And we'll just be rolling in the money. So let me tell you, I didn't think there was enough money floating around for participants to be playing the game every weekend. I tried the double weekend or the Saturday Sunday thing, and if I memory serves me correctly, that experiment lasted 3 weekends, one of which was a rainout. The third weekend, the number of participants I'm sure numbered less than 20. I abandoned the thing and went back to the, trying to put on 10, 12 events a year or something like that.
Okay.
But it was pretty funny. But as we were talking, I was remembering some of the good times at Maple Grove Dragway. I'll go back just 1 year.
Okay.
I remember some of the good times at Maple Grove Dragway. And one of the things that happened to that poor white Plymouth is that somehow had, quote, rusty fenders on it, on the car.
Was that chemically induced rust, Al?
They were brand new fenders that somehow fell into an acid dip.
Yeah, right.
So they got put on the car, and nobody realized they were on the car. You kind of did it under the cover of darkness and put the same decals on it. Sure enough, I hadn't raced that car for 1 or 2 weeks, and I think it was the Lord above saying, no, you shouldn't be using those acid-dip parts, because I'm sitting behind the burn box, and a Corvette, like a 70 or 69 Corvette, backs up to do another burnout. Well, he didn't stop at the burn box. He came past it, crashing into the front end of my pristine acid-dipped 64 Plymouth, busting it up beyond belief. The radiator was leaking all over the place. The fender came back into the door. Honest to God, I had to climb out through the window. You couldn't open the door. Well, suffice it to say, I had to put the stock fenders back on it. But kind of an anecdote that you don't always hear about. But
a little karma from above, right?
It is karma, no questioning about it. Because when I went to inspect the Corvette, in those days they had some kind of little key lock or something on the back fin,
yeah,
or whatever.
Right.
And he had, and the total damage on this Corvette that had crashed my 64 Plymouth was a little crack in the fiberglass about 2 inches long. And I'm going, really? What the heck? Well, sometimes you take away from those stories and say, yeah, you know, maybe there's a justice after all on that. Anyway,
I think that's classic. That's good. So, all right. So you're back. You're back. You got your own drag. So if you have your own drag strip, do you have a race car? And you know, where does your race even take you from there?
Well, at first, all I had was this little Streeter. I called it. It was a '63 bronze-colored non-factory paint Dodge with an aluminum front end on it. And I started out it being collector car, and then.
Mm-hmm.
They'll change the iron manifolds to headers because they were so heavy.
Yeah.
But I actually bracket raced it a little bit, and they had a big bracket race in Minnesota at a now-defunct Twin City Dragway.
Mm-hmm.
And took my Streeter out there and won this, at the time, $1,000 bracket race, was big money there. Then got to, didn't have, then started building. Oh, I maybe got a little bit of nostalgia in me and wanted to build a wagon,
yeah,
or kind of redo my wagon. And, of course, it wasn't available. The wagon was long gone, and it wasn't available. But, again, my CPA came to the rescue. He said he was driving down the street in Milwaukee and saw a 64 Plymouth wagon going the other direction. He made a U-turn and ended up stopping the guy, getting his phone number, and short story, I bought the car a little while later. When we pulled the rugs back, it was pristine. It had come from Texas. It was just pristine. There was,
yeah.
an ounce of rust on the thing. So that ended up getting turned into another Plymouth. But one of the big things that an old friend, Greg Weaver, helped manage the track at the time, because I mentioned that the track was 100 miles away from home, from my home base. So you can imagine that that creates some problems, and did it. But I kind of played around with that Plymouth and then kind of got started a little bit and went to it. And I think the best I did with the wagon was that maybe the I was looking at something and maybe at the 84 Brainerd race ended up losing in a heads up race against your hero Don McElroy. And I was at a distinct disadvantage to his CUDA or Challenger CUDA deal. We came into the burn box and faked like the car wouldn't start. And so we were way behind on the burn on the burnout and everything, and then finally just hit the button and got it started and go up there, and still plans, well-laid plans, just ended up in second place as McElroy went on to win the thing, and I couldn't catch him.
Yeah, okay, okay.
And then in that time frame, too, ended up changing jobs and ended up working for another generator company up in Minneapolis. So ended up going over there, moving from central Wisconsin up to Minneapolis, which put me 100 miles on the other side of the drag strip. The drag strip was basically halfway in between. So,
okay.
But those early years were kind of tight, and then ended up being just being like any small business. It takes a while to get them off off dead center.
I mean, having the track, were you able to, you know, get over there, test, or even, you know, sharpen your skills there?
Yeah, you'd end up, I of course would never race when there was a race going on, but anytime we'd have a test day or something, I would make runs down the deal, and it was always fun, and later on it proved to even be more fun. The next milestone that came up is that it had to be in 1985. I got a call from another friend by the name of Jim Cassie. Mm-hmm. He and his wife had a neat tan 64 Plymouth. And I don't remember whether I drove it one or two times in 1985, but I had to fly out to the World Finals and the Pomona races, the Phoenix races, that kind of stuff.
Right.
And race this car. Well, it was so much fun to get out of the winter and get out of the cold winter weather that the next year we planned to hit it a little bit heavier. And I had a good short block, and his was a standard board short block, and I had a little better short block. He had some good heads, and so I gave him the short block, and we cut a deal for a partnership in 1986, the next year. Sure enough, it ended up being a good deal.
Right. So that was your world champion, first world championship run.
It was. And we ended up, it was kind of a weird deal, but I ended up earning points with two different cars, the wagon back east and the east of the Mississippi, and the tan car west of the Mississippi. And it was really a fun time.
Right. And along with the world championship, you got the Quaker Sportsman Cup. So that was basically like the what was it? One time was the Grace Cup, I guess. Like,
yeah, I'm not sure what the I think it started out as Grace Cup and turned into the Quaker Cup. What it turned out to be is that of the sportsman classes, they took the highest point earner, kicked him this Quaker Cup, and it wasn't just a cup. The cup was filled with 15, 20 grand worth of Doremi, as I remember.
Right. So another significant payday.
It was a big deal. I think that they gave away a Kawasaki one of their street rockets with the deal. There were a lot of big deals going on there, but that year started out so good. came out there with that tan Plymouth, runnered up at the first race of the year, the Winter Nationals.
Mm-hmm.
And it was so much fun. I remember that we used to kid some of the competitors when they'd ask me about the car and in trying to be a little coy about what was in the car, or, you know, what we were doing this and what we were doing that. I would just say, you know, I get on the airplane, I fly out to the West Coast, I push the buttons, and I get back on the airplane. it was just a fun time. And then to put the, well, we were kind of in the chase for the World Championship. And
right.
I remember distinctly going out to the West Coast. And at the time, the Phoenix race was the second to last race of the year rather than in the beginning of the year. It was at the mm-hmm. end of the year. I remember talking to my good buddy Jim Greenheck, whose name will pop up later, but
right.
I remember telling Greenheck, you know, we got a chance at this thing, but boy, we need to do good on this West Coast swing and the World Finals swing. He said, and he says to me, well, just went out on it. Just went out on it like it was a matter of fact.
Yeah.
And wouldn't you know it, went out there and we won the Fall Nationals and won the World Finals. And in between, there was a Las Vegas points race when the track was kind of in a different spot or whatever.
Yep. Yeah, road track, yeah.
And runnered up to another Max Wedge in that year, or I'm sorry, at that event. And that was enough to win the World Championship, win the Quaker Cup, and you go back and look at it, and over almost not even 3 weeks, but over a 2.5 week span, we won $50,000 prize money on that deal. And that's a lot of cake.
That is big money. I didn't do the same math on that, but
well,
I think we all know.
It's big money. But it's big money in 86.
Yeah.
So we were flying high in our taxi, as the song goes.
And I got to believe the hook was already set, but that had to set the hook even deeper, didn't it?
Absolutely. Well, the hook was set in 1971, but all of a sudden, you know, things were kind of popping together and you recognized that you're going to make a life out of auto racing on two sides of the track, you know, on both sides of the fence, I should say.
Yeah, yeah.
Over the next 5 years, raced several different Max Wedge cars. I had a 64 Dodge and a 64 Dodge Plymouth. And in there, we ended up getting the Super Shop sponsorship. And
right,
painted
yellow cars.
Yellow. They were bright
yeah.
yellow. And, of course, Super Shops was owned by Mallory and all got to be close with Les Figueroa, who was on the Mallory truck at the time. And now Les runs a successful speed shop out in Las Vegas.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
That was a good time. I always have been a kind of a car collector, and during that time frame, I kind of won a few more national events, not a lot, but ended up expanding some of my collector, not necessarily
mm-hmm.
race car collectors, but just muscle car collectors.
Right.
And one of the ones that crossed my path was a 1968 real 68 Hemi Cuda race car. But then these are the trade-offs that you make on it. Well, we kind of rebuilt it into restored the thing into more of a showpiece than a real race car.
Mm-hmm.
But it was the number 3 serial number car, and it was owned by Ostrich, Iowa racer, Chuck Ostrich.
Yeah. Right, I recall that. Yep.
So it ended up, but as life goes, all of a sudden the drag strip needed re-asphalting. It was about, I would imagine that the year was 89, 90 or something like that,
mm-hmm.
where
right.
the asphalt was getting a little used and abused. And I ended up selling in the early 90s, I ended up selling that car out east in order to help finance the asphalt job
okay.
on at the racetrack. So it's kind of there's some sacrifices that you make on it, but luckily, I had the wherewithal to peddle some of that stuff.
Oh yeah, the right investment in your
trade dollars
at the time. Yeah,
I think at that time, weren't those cars doing pretty well in terms of value?
Yeah, they were, in my mind, it was a kind of a trade-off. I remember basically almost came for the big asphalt job that we did at the racetrack, which included doing some pit work and staging lanes and all the rest of that stuff, and the track itself. It was very, I don't know, I'm sure it was less than $100,000, but back then $100,000 was a lot of money. And
that's right.
I remember specifically, and these are the good days of racetrack operation. I remember specifically the year that we put the fresh asphalt down, that we advertised and marketed the track and, you know, come on out to the track and see the brand new asphalt. And I remember specifically that we ran all 12 events of the year that we ran without a single rainout. And, of course, it helped the coffers a little bit to pay for the rest of the asphalt job.
You had a really strong closeout in the 80s. That was a good end of the decade for you. And then I think I just saw recently that you were cited as one of the Indy champions that has the longest span between wins, between your 71 Indy win and 93.
Yep. Well, that brings us up to 93. And,
right.
No, I'm not sure how you look at that. Is that a plus or a minus? It's the longest year. You know? Oh, but by the way, won Indy twice, so it's not the end of the world. But it was 22 years between, and I'm surprised you picked up on that, but I did see National Dragster give me that, let's say, dubious honor of being the longest time frame between Indy wins, but
right.
A win's a win.
Yeah,
but
no. Yeah.
But on the other side of things, about that time, I ended up going into the racetrack business full time and left the generator company from Minneapolis and got into was doing the racetrack deal full time. So that was a lot of fun. But the fun part was came at, just as you mentioned, at the 93 U.S. Nationals, where I won it with another 64 Plymouth Max Wedge.
Right.
A fun deal, because it ended up being a springboard for a Chrysler deal. At the time, Chrysler was thinking about doing various versions of their plan, but they were just reintroducing Hemi parts. So they wanted to have some Cudas and Plymouths and Dodge Challengers running their cars. They decided to do it with the Dodges instead of the Plymouths. At first they said, well, let's have one of every of the factory high-intensity, high-impact colors.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that went by the wayside, and they ended up doing two black and white Challengers. They chose the Dodges instead. And,
right.
Oh, you probably remember some of the names at Chrysler at the time, Dave Koffel and Larry Henry helped an awful lot in getting some of those, in getting that Challenger done. And, but on our end, we took a body off. We did a body off on the thing, and my best guy, Kurt Anderson, who is a racer and a craftsman extraordinaire, built that car with the cage and everything in it on a rotisserie. My other lifelong friend in the Mopar business, Russ Behrens, helped finish that thing off and helped get that thing working. It turned out to be a pretty good car. We ended up got into moving forward a little bit. I guess we ended up taking the car out to the Winter Nationals in 1997, winning the Winter Nationals, catching a Winnebago motorhome sponsorship. So that was pretty cool. Just had a heck of a year. Ended up winning the World Championship again, the Stock Luminaire World Championship again back in 97.
Right, so 11 years span there between 86 and 97 World Championships.
But there's an aside to that story. One time we were down in, we were down in Louisiana or Texas someplace, and I'm making a time trial or something on a Thursday or Friday, and I don't remember all the details of it except the fact that we kicked a rod out of the out of that Challenger, out of that Hemi Challenger, talked about a small world, called back up north, and it turned out that none other than Jason Lyne was coming down to the next race. And I said, hey, will you stop over at the engine shop and pick up my spare Hemi? honest to God, I had the Lyne family help him change a Hemi motor in that Challenger.
Okay.
Doing the Jason brought that Hemi down for me. He may not remember the story. Maybe he probably will. Get down there and all of a sudden everybody's pitching in and changing their motors. But it's kind of a fun deal.
And that was Wheeler still building your motors at that time?
Yep. So Wheeler was still doing the motors, and we didn't. We transitioned into ended up using another engine shop on some of the LS stuff, Wagner's.
Okay. But also Wagner from the Heartland there, another one of your homeboys, right?
Yeah, that's it. But that kind of transitions, and it's kind of funny. The last race of that deal, Chrysler kind of lost interest in their Hemi parts program with Stock Eliminator, and I kind of got interested in some of the EFI stuff there in 99, and so I put together a proposal to get one of the new Firebirds, or one of the new Firebirds at the time, from Pontiac, and make the switch from carburetors to EFI.
Right.
And luckily, you've been in the business over there in Detroit and there, you had a lot of the people that helped me get that program going, but Fred Simmons over at Pontiac and Harry Turner, they were both instrumental in getting the deal. But the last race, kind of an interesting side note, the last race for that Challenger made it to the world finals, into the final, and then got beat by a six-pack Chucky Rayburn. In the final. And from there, I seem to recall on the way home, my buddy Russ Behrens somehow had an arm's length relationship through some relatives with the wrestler Bill Goldberg.
Yeah.
And Bill Goldberg ended up buying that that car, and we delivered it later on to those guys down there. He's kind of a Hemi Mopar sort of guy, and they went with it. But didn't stay with him forever, but he was the one that bought it, and we ended up. But Mike Pastelny built another just excellent craftsman, my first Pontiac, and had an LT1 Pontiac for a short period of time. I just bought one to just make sure that I liked driving those Pontiacs.
Right.
But we didn't use the LT1 Pontiac very long and make it way for the yellow Firebird and with the LS1 package in it, which turned out to be great. And at the time, ended up getting one of the smartest guys that I know in the fuel injection business, but that was Brian Ebert. He helped me make that transition and make it look really easy. He was just unbelievable help. And
so so this is a major transition from your Mopar world and now we're moving into the modern era, you know, with some new stuff.
And that was the first year. It was so much fun. And of course, you know, at the time, the Pontiacs were underrated. I think everybody recognizes that Charvy and the manufacturers wanted to see more new cars in the Eliminator.
Right.
Didn't come as any surprise. So they thought, well, we'll underrate them just a little bit. Well, maybe more than a little bit, but we'll underrate them, and people will tend to use them. And certainly it was effective, because if you look at all the LT1 Firebirds that came out in the mid to late 90s, well, then all of a sudden they're making that transition to a newer motor, the LS1, and nobody was really running that motor. So I thought, well, this is the thing to come. This is the new motor that GM is banking on, so let's get involved with that on the ground floor. But the best part of that deal probably was the most fun things was at that time, they started doing a separate race, one race in the year, and they called it Top Stock, and it was going to be at Norwalk.
I remember that. I was there watching that, and I remember your performance vividly there, Al.
You do. We haven't talked about this. We haven't talked about this beforehand, I don't think. But it it was just a fun deal. And, I don't know, 20-some cars showed up to this deal, and it was pushed all year long. And at the time, I was getting help from Holly, and at the time, Tom Jenkins, and later Robin Lawrence from Holly. Well, Jenkins was throwing money at this thing and saying, well, you know, helping fund this thing. And one of your local racers, Mike Tinner, was big on getting it. And the whole idea behind Top Stock was to try to find an in-between ground between the A stockers and the B stockers, wherein you'd actually add weight to the A's and take weight off of the B's and let them all duke it out. But we went over there, and I can even remember beforehand, my friend, Max Wedge guy from Minneapolis, Gene Mott, he said to me, Al, what do you think of this Top Stock deal? And I said, Gene, I wouldn't miss it for the world. Just imagine leaning on the fence, and this is a true story, leaning on the fence, watching all that old iron, and watching all that old iron go down there with no holds barred and all the rest of the stuff. I mean, you could even smell the ERC gasoline at the time.
That was one of my main takeaways, was just the ERC was heavy in the air. It was almost like a nitro in the air, wasn't it?
Well, it was a horsepower expander. That's just a multiplier.
Right.
Well, the funny part of the story, from my perspective, is that they were going to compete. They were going to use this Top Stock deal. Turned out to be a halfway decent money deal, maybe $5,000 or something like that.
Uh-huh.
But the thing it was, they wanted to make it more like a professional deal.
Right.
So they ended up instituting the Pro Tree, but not at 4/10, at 5/10. And, of course, as I'm telling Mosbeck story, you asked about doing testing at the Rock Falls racetrack. And guess what? I was back there knowing full well that they were going to allow the late model cars to compete at an extremely light weight. And I was back at my racetrack practicing on that 500 Pro Tree to make sure it wasn't the first time that I ever saw it when we got to Norwalk.
Yeah.
And, of course, you probably recognize that I ended up winning the thing. Some of the guys were having traction problems, and of course, when everybody's on the same 9-inch tire and you've got a smaller motor and a lighter car, you probably have a little bit of an advantage. And the car was when you took all the weight out of the car, it was plenty fast.
Yeah,
but it was so funny because, of course, at the end of this deal, off comes the cylinder head to verify everything. I remember that my buddy Jim Bailey, who at the time was getting out of Top Fuel and into Max Wedge Racing, and he also was having a car built over at Kurt Anderson's place. He comes over and helps and all that stuff. And these guys are just amazed that that this thing is still a stock piston, stock short block motor, and as we're taking it apart on the back end of my trailer. It was quite the deal.
That was an amazing race. Jim and Matt Morgan. I remember Jim Waldo tuned in the Alois car. It was some great races.
There were a lot of guys from. I mean, like I said, Waldo came from the West Coast or from the Northwest, and had a lot of this. And I don't know. We just had when everything falls into place, it's always a fun time. I don't think they were very happy about the fact that. That some LS1 small took advantage of their big black old iron, especially when you had the turncoat Alcorta, coming from the Max Wedge and Hemi background, and all of a sudden abandoning ship, so to speak, and jumping in some blasted Pontiac Firebird. But of course, it had a short wheelbase deal, and as I've always said on those short wheelbase cars. You know, when everybody else is staging wherever they stage, whether you call it a 108, 110, 112, 116 wheelbase, the Firebirds were at 101 wheelbase, and bald spots, step to the front of that. Al, why don't you stage your car in front of that bald spot? We don't want to make you. We don't want to handicap you too much by having to drive through that bald spot. Oh, okay, that'll do.
So you started then in 2000 on the LS platform, and you're still there.
Yeah, that's a fun platform.
The NMCA thing has really worked out well for you, especially with your LS cars.
Well, it turns out that I guess I just wanted to mention, you know, before we transition into some of the NMCA stuff.
Yeah.
One of the things that was really neat, of course, in I think it was 2003, they separated the fuel cars from the traditional stock eliminator cars by creating fuel injected classes.
Mm-hmm.
And we came out to the Winter Nationals, and it was so funny because my friend Bill Nelson texted Alan Reinhardt up in the tower, who happened to be announcing, and the text or phone call was simply just watch this, and it was I was about the fifth or tenth car or whatever seventh car down the track in the first day of the morning of the thing.
Yeah.
And it was in the new A fuel class deal, which meant that it could run a little lighter weight. I guess basically you could take it down to 8 pounds. And all of a sudden that car runs 997, first small block in the nines at a national event.
Yeah, okay.
And at the time, around that time, I ended up getting a full-time manager for the racetrack, Jennifer Anderson, who still works for Greenheck out there. And just does a marvelous job, and she did a great job for me and freed up time for me and for me doing that. And also at the time, this idea didn't work out all that well, but I ended up building another Firebird, an orange one, that would run in super stock.
Okay.
And we ran it a couple of times, and I thought that there was an advantage to running it in super stock, but keeping it more like a stocker in that it was about the same ET. And you could drive it the same, and the Christmas tree reaction times were about the same. But that didn't work out quite that well. Still ended
up. Now, were you bringing both to the track at the same time, running both classes?
Well, I ended up building a 34-foot trailer and was able to squeeze a tight fit. But, yeah,
okay.
was able to squeeze two 16-foot Firebirds into a 34-foot trailer. Not a lot of room. A lot of guys don't like that. You know, don't like to be quite tight, but... we always called it a hot dog trailer. It was plenty long. It sure looked long behind a
plate,
that kind of stuff. But, yeah, that was a fun times. But things keep changing as you... I mentioned once to you that I've gone through 20 race cars in my life. That's a lot of race cars.
That is a lot of race cars.
Maybe it just shows a short attention span. Maybe that's the way to look at it.
But you think about it, switching out the wagons to sedans to the convertibles back in the Max Wedge days, and
back in those days, it didn't seem like a big deal because you weren't working on the chassis that much.
Right, they weren't science out like they are today.
They weren't science out. And, it was a pretty easy transition.
Yeah.
But going back to the NMCA thing, as I got into it a little bit. First started getting interested in it in the nostalgia superstock side of the deal. And that nostalgia superstock thing, it's kind of stereotypical, stereotyped as an old guy deal where they don't have a lot of engine rules. They've got some chassis rules and whatnot. And crossed paths with, I decided that I wanted to put together a nostalgia superstock car. So I did a 64 Plymouth. Raced it, got lucky with it in 2008, and there's the biggest nostalgia superstock race is something they call the Dave Duell Classic that's put on by his son, Doug Duell, who's just a great guy that I've got to be great friends with after we, I kind of moved into some of the nostalgia superstock stuff, and he kind of moved into the stock eliminator stuff a couple of his cars. A good friend, but I ended up winning that five grander in 2008 over at St. Louis. It was a big deal at the time.
And as I recall, big car count too, right?
Oh, those are, I think they maybe didn't have, there'd be 70, 75 cars on the property.
Yeah.
That kind of a deal. Maybe they all didn't make it to the first round, but still, it's the biggest nostalgia superstock race of the year.
Yeah, right.
Something like that. And fun race, and it brings out everybody in the nostalgia view.
Yeah.
And I kind of played around with some of those cars, and I did an LS1 Corvette. The Corvette had a chassis advantage, or a horsepower advantage from the Firebirds got beat up quite a bit on horsepower factoring, but the Corvettes didn't. There weren't as many Corvettes running.
Did you build that or did you buy that car?
Oh, I bought the car. Stan Holt built the car originally and then ended up selling it, and he ended up, I ended up buying it after the fact, or after he sold it to the next guy. I just bought it as a roller and whatnot, and played around with some of that stuff. Didn't win that many races with the Firebirds. I think it won a couple of races with the Firebirds in stock, but it almost goes without saying that winning an NHRA national event is a lot tougher today than it was in the old days. I mean, it's almost been 20 years since I've won one.
That means you're due to win Indy again, isn't it?
Yeah, that's a big dream. You know, I've been in this deal. If you do the math on it, I've been in the thing over 50 years. I mean, this is 50th year. This will be the 50th year anniversary of 1971. I'm just happy. You know, I'm an old guy, just happy. I go out there, stage the car, close my eyes, count to three, and hope that it's green. You know, and it happens to be working for me most of the time.
Some of the time. Well, I don't know. Al, I watch you race, and like I've told you many times, you give me so much hope because you are still killer on the tree.
I'm just lucky.
I don't know.
I get it.
2016 Division V Hall of Fame. And for listeners, Google Al Porter. There's a really nice, very well done YouTube on Al and his history. A short piece, thing about 5 minutes, but very well done. Pretty cool. The Division V Hall of Fame.
That's kind of humbling. But I guess the year before that, I ended up finally selling the track after 37 years. Ended up selling the racetrack and retiring from business, essentially. I couldn't have found a better guy to buy it. I mentioned that I'd mention his name again later on, and that's Jim Greenheck. He's a comp eliminator racer and an accomplished businessman over in central Wisconsin. I remember that he put the roll bar in my wagon when we rebuilt it back in the 80s. We go back a long way on the thing, and he's just making improvements hand over fist. The company is doing well, and he's making improvements to Rock Falls Raceway. It's going to be a premier destination racetrack in the Minneapolis metro area. As you know, you're a big fan of these stock, super stock combo races.
Oh, yeah.
You help organize that Great Lakes deal, and I'm on the other side of the lake, so we do the Midwest one. For the last couple of years, they've had a couple of four grander stock eliminator deals. I know that last year there were 112 stock, super stock combo racers come out to that race, and it's a four grand to win on Saturday, four grand to win on Sunday, thick challenge on Friday, and yeah, you'll be able to.
I know. I look at the Midwest. The Midwest Association does a great job. You know, it's 100 cars. It's just about all their race. You know, they have the Earlville race right after Indy, and
yeah.
You know, I think it's 120 cars they get. It's just great racing.
It's a fun deal. It pays back, and you know, I actually think that might be some of the future of stock and super stock racing. It's so much fun. It only takes 2 days. You get two races to go to, camaraderie, usually some kind of type of a barbecue or whatever.
Yep.
Going on.
Right. And it's racing like we used to. I mean, we raced, you know, the great thing is you run the whole race within a span of 3 or 4 hours. It's great racing. The guys are right on their dials and they're sharp on the tree. And it's like you said, it's just good fun racing.
Yeah, it is a good deal. But you were talking about NMCA, and you mentioned LS coming back around on that. I think it was back 15 or 16, someplace back in there. Actually won one of their championships in Street King, which is an index class. It's limited to LS, sponsored by Chevrolet and limited to LS-powered equipment, but it's run in an index form, and by that everybody recognizes it. Quarter second index is also a pro tree, 5/10 pro tree, but it's still kind of fun. And that's one of the things. Some of the NMCA stuff is a
yeah, and I've marveled. You know, I've gone to a lot of the NMCA races, and you know, I see you double entered in some of these classes, and boy, you were just I was always back in the staging lane. It seemed like
well, it's a fun deal, a lot of fun. Those guys put on a good show, and everything. It's
so. I mean, as a 2-time world champion, you've been lucky enough to hold a gold card. That does get you into national events. So. Here, I mean, of course, 2020, we don't know what's going to happen, but do you think you'll still run some NHRA stuff, Al? Or I know, you know, you and I both talk a lot about the local stuff, and what do you think you'll be doing going forward?
I just love the all sorts of racing. No question, I think that some of the NMCA stuff is fun. And nostalgia stuff is fun. I love the NHRA deal. There's an old baseball saying, drag racing been a bear good to me. And,
oh, wait a second. That's not baseball. I guess I stole that from somebody.
That's based on some of my earlier math. I think that you can say that.
But, it's been very good to me. And back a few years ago, I kind of made, after I got out of the racetrack business, ended up moving into one of those new Camaros, happened to 15, kind of like a Copo, except it was the Copo deal without the motor. CRC, I think, is the official name of them. So I worked with Scoggin Dickey and my guy, Nicky Fuller, down there, and ended up buying one of those empty Camaros, and we put a Copo motor in it for the first year, and then second year, well, late 2016, Chevrolet developed and submitted the specs for a street Camaro in stock Eliminator, and so I switched over to an LS3 in that particular deal. Ended up race out here quite a bit. We've got a fledgling Arizona Stock Superstock Association that we've been going to, and I was lucky enough to win that championship 3 years running, 17, 18, and 19 out here on the West Coast. Keeps you sharp.
Yeah, the car count's been growing pretty nicely in that series.
Yeah, they I don't think they're as good as your Great Lakes deal, and certainly not as good as the Midwest deal, but we're working on it.
Yeah.
The brothers do a tremendous job of promoting that deal.
Mm-hmm.
And
well, I've got to give you the opportunity. I mean, you've mentioned a lot of people that have helped along the way. Is there anybody that you've missed along the way?
There's a few guys that have helped me out an awful lot over the years. So Mike and Paula Cotton live down, I'm over in Phoenix, and Mike and Paula Cotton live down the street or whatever, 10 miles away, and they're just great people, and get involved with them an awful lot. But a couple of the other guys that have helped me an awful lot, I've mentioned all the names as we've been going along,
right.
And Dave Gerchen helps me out here an awful lot, Gary Capera back in your area is an old friend that motivates me and keeps me on the straight and narrow. And another guy in locally here that helps stage the car an awful lot when he's at the races is Mike Mingo. These guys are just they really are helpful and everything. And over the years, in the old days, Steve Harrington, Frank Lupo from Dynamic Converters. He's always been a big supporter, helped us an awful lot. And, of course, I mentioned for a while, Mancini, Ron Prav over at Mancini Racing
was
helping us when we were in the Mopar business. But I also like to thank my buddy Les Lienert, who's helped me forever. John McLeod has led that Midwest class racer deal, and he brings a lot of racing to the Midwest. Mike Stensrud at Wagner's helps me an awful lot with the engines. And also like to thank the transmission guys, Dave Smith at Pro Trains and Scott McClay. Keith Jones at Total Seal always keeps things sealed up for us. Other guys that have been around and helped me a lot in the past, Steve Queen, Bob Gansey, Mike Gruber, Tom Dahlberg, Glenn Domingue, Wayne Lambrecht, John Balo, John Simon, and Steve Valdez. Thanks to all of those folks, and especially the sanctioning bodies, tech guys, and the fans. an awful lot of people that helped me on the way. I know that you know, if you look at my hero card, the list is pretty long of people that I'm in.
It's very long. It's very long.
It's an awful lot of people that have really helped me along the way, and you know, it helps me lucky. Like I said, you just close your eyes.
Oh, I wish it was that simple, Al.
Some days it is.
Yeah, you're right.
Some days it is.
I mean, I want to thank you for taking the time to share some of your career highlights. And, I mean, I've told this before. Guys like you, you're a few years older than me, and you continue to be really competitive and really, you know, strong. And I tell you, it gives me, I'm 65, and it gives me hope that there's still lots of good years left. And I hope when you get back to it, you stay with it.
Oh, there's no question that, you know, I enjoy it. And no question that I'm going to be hanging in there as long as the good Lord lets me. Good luck so far. And keep
good.
It going.
All right, well, Al, thank you very much, and wish you good luck this year whenever we get back to racing.
Thanks. Same to you. Bye-bye.
All right.
Listeners, hold on for a minute. We've got a little bonus audio from Al that we thought you might want to hear.
But and you didn't even get to the gas tank deal. And
well,
how the heck do you remember?
Oh, wait. I have the ability to edit that in, so... Thank you for reminding me. So here's what I want to do. let's just do this quick, and I will edit this and enter it. Oh,
you'll insert it someplace.
Al, before we leave, I got one question for you, and I think the statute of limitations has expired, so you can probably speak freely. The wagon gas tank, what's the deal? Which side should it really be on, and how did that ever work out?
Huh. Let me see if I can refresh my memory about that. That was a long time ago. Well, the way I remember it is that the Canadian wagons, Plymouth wagons, came with the gas tank on the passenger side instead of like on the U.S. because they had the gas pumps on the other, they were different up in Canada.
It was a liter thing versus gallon, right?
Well, it's liters versus gallons, yeah. But they also had to fill them from the other side. So the Canadian Plymouth wagons... had the gas tank on the passenger side. And it turns out, when you think about it, it's probably a little bit better for as far as weight distribution. Let's say you got a 75-pound gas tank, and in the day, back in those days, they weren't allowing fuel cells in stock eliminator craft. So you had to use a standard tank. And it turns out that, kind of switching 75 pounds from the driver's side to the passenger side, rear, that's probably a pretty good idea. And I don't know how we were lucky enough to find that car that had the gas tank on that side. But worked out. It worked out for us.
That's great. Hey, how long were you able to make that work before it got a little sticky?
Well, the way I remember it, it turns out that the original wagon was a U.S. wagon, and when I got on a nostalgia kick in the 80s and rebuilt it and found that other car, that turned out, even though I mentioned it was a Texas had Texas plates on it, it was originally built in Canada.
Okay.
So consequently, it had the gas tank on the other side. And as you go along, what happened, I remember it specifically. At some point in time, they were reminiscing about the good old days, and it was probably when they were telling about the wagon or winning Indy or something way back in the old days. So they put two pictures of my wagons back to back, like a 71 picture, and then... I imagine that would be an 86 World Championship picture or something along those lines.
Right.
And they had them to the point where the two pictures were right on top of each other, and the gas tanks were showing on opposite sides, and that's when all the controversy arose. But of course, like you mentioned, the statute of limitations has run out.
So, okay.
That Canadian story, the story about the Canadian, that's my story, and I'm sticking to it as the line, as the familiar line goes.
Well, you know, Jack McCormick will vouch for you, because he told me the same thing. He verified, in fact, that was, in fact, a Canadian gas tank.
We love it. You got to come up with the best lines, and I love the Canadian thing.
Yeah, that's great. That's great. All right. Well, I'll figure out a way to weave that in there somewhere along the way.
Oh, that's a good one, though.
Yeah. That's good.
No, that was funny. It really was a funny thing. And you know, the funny part of it was that when we put it in there, I always suspected that one day we're gonna get slammed with that.
Yeah.
And for the longest time, I carried another gas tank with me and knew exactly where you had to chip out the plastic,
Bondo.
You know, the Bondo, in order to put the other thing, you know, to put it back in on the other side, and yada, yada. And it was
I hope you enjoyed these great stories from Al. If you like these podcasts, please hit the heart button, and we welcome your comments on what you would like to hear in future episodes. Thanks for listening.